Hello, and welcome to Gamification Unlocked, a show about real games and how we can use their techniques for learning and change. I'm Chad Haefeli. I work in user experience in libraries.
And I'm Brandon Carper. I am a training designer.
And today we have a lockpick episode where we examine a game and its techniques a little more briefly than we've done so far. Today, we're going to take a look at the awkwardly named Mr. Robot :1.51 Exfiltration. And then there's like a file extension on it for some reason, depending on which platform you're using. But I'm just going to call it the Mr. Robot mobile game for ease of use. So, Brandon, you are a fellow Mr. Robot fan, correct?
I am. I did not know it existed until right before Season 2 started, I think.
So you got to binge on everything?
I did. So we binged Season 1 in about 2 nights.
That sounds similar to my experience.
And we're currently watching Season 2.
Yep. So we should say up front, there might be a spoiler or two in this review, but I think we'll try to confine it to Season 1 for the most part. But a little bit of background if you're not a Mr. Robot fan, although you should watch it because you will be. It's a show about hackers and kind of technology's role in our society, and it's a little bit of a conspiracy thriller, and I don't know, how would you sum it up?
Yeah, I would agree. It reminds me of a genre that I enjoy called cyberpunk, where
yes.
There's usually a plot involving a massive monolithic corporation, and then there are a bunch of smaller people who are trying to fight back against the corporation on their own, and the only way they can do that is usually by hacking through computer systems.
Yes, though cyberpunk has a few more cyborgs generally involved than Mr. Robot has shown so far.
Oh, correct. So far. It's much more of a near future cyberpunk setting.
Yeah. And I believe this is the first official game that they've had. It's a mobile game, so it's out for iOS and Android devices. And it was produced in part by a company called Telltale Games, who I think we've both played a number of their products before. They're kind of known for what, it sounds a little derogatory, but I don't mean it that way, called like choose your own adventure style games. You know, they're less about Twitch reactions to things and more about involving yourself in the story and the characters and thinking about what people would say at different points and then seeing the consequences of those decisions played out later in the game.
Sure. So as opposed to, like you said, Twitch games where the game is more about fast reflexes. Yeah, Telltale Games, I think their most famous game was Walking Dead.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually the only exposure I have to the Walking Dead universe personally is their game.
Yeah, but they've carved out this nice little niche for themselves. I think they recently did a Batman game that's out now. They've done a Game of Thrones game.
They did a Minecraft game is my...
Yes, of all things.
I haven't played it, but it's my favorite somehow, I think.
Just that it exists.
Actually, my favorite, they did a version of Borderlands called Tales from the Borderlands.
Mm-hmm.
That's based on a series of games that kind of meld the Wild West with a sci-fi space universe. A little bit like Firefly, I guess.
I think, didn't they have a Jurassic Park game at one point?
Those were before Walking Dead, maybe. So before they really struck gold with their formula.
Yeah, and Back to the Future, maybe. But they kind of excel at taking these known properties and turning them into interesting narrative experiences. And what I want to talk about with the Mr. Robot game is how it relates to the idea of a genre known as alternate reality games, or ARGs, or ARGs, depending on how you pronounce it, and a little bit of experiential learning thrown in also. So an alternate reality game, at its core, tries to remove the barrier between you and the game. One of the first ones was a promotion for the movie AI, where in many ways I think the game may have outlived the relevance of the film, but it was called The Beast, and there were hidden codes in the movie posters, and you could make phone calls and interact with characters. They hired real actors at one point to go meet players out in the city. So the game was played in the real world. That's the platform. I got into it with a game called I Love Bees in 2005, which was a promotion for Halo 2 that involved a mass coordination of answering payphones around the country, which sounds really weird when I put it that way, but trust me, it was a lot of fun. More modern incarnations of it, you might view Ingress, the predecessor to Pokemon Go, made by Niantic, where you have to use your phone to go places in the physical world to kind of play a giant capture the flag game and claim things for your team. And then, as I mentioned, Pokemon Go might be the king of all alternate reality games at this point.
So, Chad, would you distinguish between augmented reality and alternate reality?
Ah, good question. I think there's there is a distinction between them. And I think Pokemon Go is probably both, because you're using your phone's camera to augment the reality by layering things on top of the image. So you see the Pokemon standing on a fountain or on your desk or whatever as you're out and around. Whereas alternate reality would ask you to believe in some sort of fiction layered on top of your world as you go. And Pokemon Go would have that also, the fiction of the creatures around. But alternate reality games in general don't necessarily require that level of technological connection to things. It can be much more narrative-based, which is a nice connection to the kind of things Telltale games have been doing.
Oh, interesting distinction. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I disclaimer, there's probably people who can explain it much better than I do, but that's my take on it. And the way Mr. Robot kind of taps into this idea of an alternate reality game, more so than augmented, I think, is that the entire game itself looks and functions like a messaging app. And in the fiction of the show, there's a company called E-Corp, or as Elliot, the main character, refers to it, Evil Corp. And it's the big monolithic company that you mentioned in the kind of cyberpunk staple. And in the fiction of the world, they do everything. They're kind of an Apple meets Amazon meets a little bit of everything that we might have in our world. And so this is their messaging app, their equivalent of Facebook Messenger or the like. And all your interaction through the game is done by sending messages to and from characters. And they really made it look like a messaging app down to the little details. There's a user agreement you have to agree to when you sign into it. It might be the only user agreement I've ever actually read as I started up an app, because I was a little bit curious about what was in it. It was a little bit disappointingly free of Easter eggs, honestly. It was just a standard legal boilerplate, but a short one. And so you receive text messages from characters on the show and other characters invented for the game through the phone, and you have to reply to them, and the whole game takes place via these conversations. And it's all multiple choice. So in traditional Telltale fashion, you'll receive a message from a character, and then you're given usually three options, or up to three options, of how you might reply to that. And you select the one you want, you get some time to choose if that's the message you really want to send it off, and the interaction continues. And there's some images sent back and forth a little bit. You don't take any pictures yourself with the camera on your phone, but other characters may send you images that you can then forward on to different destinations as needed.
So who are some characters from the show that you might interact with?
Elliot and Darlene are the big two, I think. Elliot being the protagonist, and oh, I guess I shouldn't say who Darlene is exactly. Could reveal something.
Another hacker.
Yes, another hacker. And the main fiction of the story is you find this phone, and it is Darlene's phone, or one of her many burner phones that she uses in her nefarious hacking duties. And if I have one criticism of the game, it's a little unclear why she needs you to pretend to be her, but she does. And so that you kind of... She's, you know, the Cyrano and feeds you lines. I'm probably getting that reference wrong.
No, I think you're good.
Yeah, thank you.
Cyrano, famous French play about hacking the corporate mainframe.
Yes, little known fact that there was that sequel. And you kind of go on missions for a group known in the show as F Society. You become one of the group of hackers that are trying to right the wrongs of the world, and you end up essentially having to social engineer your way out of different places. So Darlene might say that she needs a certain employee's credentials upgraded to administrator level, and you have to contact via text the HR department's helpline and convince them that you are this person and you need your credentials upped and the like. And it takes some dark turns at some point. There's some moral dilemmas introduced. You start to get leverage over these different people with the things you need from them. You discover that one guy likes to frequent a certain prostitute, and then you have a choice of whether or not to tell his son about this as part of blackmailing him. So it's definitely not a child-friendly game, but neither is the show. So I guess it stays true to that tone. And if there's a clear kind of gaming ancestor to it, it would be Majestic, which I have to admit I did not play, but it was a PC game produced by EA in, I think, about 2001 or 2002, which involved making phone calls to you, sending you faxes, sending you emails at certain times. So there's roots in this in the gaming world, and there's probably other games that have been played with chatbots and the like, but this was one of the first major media properties I've seen it applied to in an interesting way.
Faxes, even.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that kind of dates it right there.
Wow, those cost money.
Both to send and receive.
Right. Well, I was going to ask, so I know in some of the alternate reality games you've played, the story kind of evolves as the game progresses based on how the community is playing it. Is that correct?
Yes, many of them have. A lot of the writers end up scrambling to rewrite their story halfway through as the community makes choices they might not have expected. So,
Is that the same here in Mr. Robot, or is it a self-contained individual experience?
I think it's much more self-contained, and that's probably because it's designed to be repeatable in a lot of ways, whereas a lot of alternate reality games are kind of one-time experiences because they require live people to be monitoring the progress of the players and the progress of the game, whereas Mr. Robot is very much on rails. And there's a couple points where you can kind of see the outcomes of your decision, but like most Telltale games that I've played, it's really kind of clear that there's really only two or three major routes to take through the story at most. But it is still kind of neat to see the outcomes of your decisions and reactions to things.
Can you play through it all in one sitting, or does it enforce you have to wait for Darlene to get back to you type?
Oh, that's a good point. It does enforce that in that bit of reality. So at one point, Darlene might say, "You'll hear from someone in an hour," and it really might take an hour to get that text from the next person. It probably took me from start to finish, maybe like 2.5-3 days. I think I did it over a weekend, mostly. And some of that is dependent on your play. You know, if someone sends you a message in an hour and you don't respond to it for another 6 hours, then the game takes longer to play. But if you stay right on top of things, you could probably get through it in a couple days. And it made me think a lot about possibly using this kind of thing as training or as other sort of guidance in experiential learning. You know, Facebook has more than 11,000 chatbots now, supposedly, including one I read about today that is a Starbucks pumpkin spice latte themed chatbot. For some reason, it will answer all your questions about pumpkin spice lattes if you have them. Yes. And they're betting big on this kind of thing.
I've heard about these, but can I ask a silly question of why? Like,
you expect that I have an answer. I like that. Partially, I think it's one of those self-perpetuating things where Facebook has more than 11,000 of them, so Starbucks decides they need to be part of it.
Like, if I want to find out about pumpkin spice latte, my choices, I feel like, are I can Google it, or I can go to a chatbot, and I feel like the chatbot would be fun from a novelty perspective, but when I want my pumpkin spice latte facts right now, I'll probably just go to Google.
Or just go to Starbucks, because what do you really need to know about the pumpkin spice latte? But I agree with you in a lot of ways. And, you know, the pumpkin spice latte, other than marketing and trying to get you to buy a pumpkin spice latte, presumably, doesn't really have a training aspect to it, I don't think. And I think that might be something that a lot of these chatbots are overlooking. The idea of more closely simulating a real conversation and a real experience and giving you options. And Facebook's done that a little bit. I think they're starting to realize some of the limitations of a text-only interface with chatbot conversation. Sometimes buttons pop up in the middle of the conversation.
Oh.
So I think there's some shopping ones. And so instead of saying, "Hey, I'd like to buy that, please," it might pop up with a buy option, which I'm still not convinced is an ideal interface for this thing by any means. But it reminded me a lot, back and forth, the Mr. Robot game and that experience reminded me of each other a lot, of kind of having canned responses to use in given situations, but still allowing some measure of freedom in the way you progress through a conversation.
I believe the first chatbot operated mainly by repeating back to you what you said.
Mm-hmm.
And it simulated
with a question mark attached.
Right. It simulated a psychiatrist or a therapist, rather. And mm-hmm. I think when it was really new, people would, I guess, sneak in or lock themselves in the computer lab because that was the only way you could access a computer in those days, and they felt like they were making some type of connection or learning more about themselves just because a computer was repeating back to themselves what they had said. How much of that is there in modern chatbots, do you know?
Very, very much of it when it doesn't understand you, I think. Like, when you manage to go off the rails or off script, it'll say, "What do you mean by blah, 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 blah that you just said?" Or, "That's something I don't understand. Can you ask me that in a different way?"
Oh, Alexa does that to me all the time.
Yep, exactly. And we probably just set off everyone's Echo who might be listening.
Yeah, little known fact, Amazon device hears her own name while she's playing a podcast, she will attempt to give herself orders.
This is how Skynet begins.
Yeah, that's what I said.
Yep.
So that's a good point, because studies have shown that people learn better when they feel like a real person is talking mm-hmm. to them.
No, and it provides some opportunity for reflection also, I think, that the bot could ask questions and reinforce things. Not that I'm saying Mr. Robot does that by any means, but it was at least things that made me think about while playing.
That's really interesting, because in theory you're supposed to end every training experience with something that a guy called Merrill termed integration, which is relating what you learned back into your life and how you can use that on the job. But when you're doing something self-paced, it's difficult and awkward to say, well, why don't you sit back and reflect on what you just learned? But if there's a simulated person actually asking you that and some type of question, then you feel, I think, more motivated to respond, even if that bot won't do anything with what you get back to it.
Yeah, that's a pretty perfect analysis, I think. Have you ever used Slack, the chat program?
I've heard of it, but have not used it.
It's used for a lot of kind of corporate internal communications. You have a chat room with your team or your department and the like. And it does a fascinating thing with a bot when you first sign up. There's the Slack bot who will ask you questions when you first sign in. It will say, hi, what's your name? You respond back to it, and it sets up your profile based on these questions that it asks you instead of asking you to fill out a form or check various boxes.
I wonder how much data validation happens during that process.
That's a really good question. I'm sorry, your name had too many numbers in it. Please say it again. But I think we're approaching a point with language processing that these things can become more useful and possibly be used for training and something that feels more like that facilitator in the process who can help you nail things down.
Right. Well, I remember watching Watson on Jeopardy. How many years ago was that?
Not that many, but probably more than I realize.
Right. And that was phenomenal, because I think the big hurdle they were trying to surmount was all the different meanings a word can have, right? Mm-hmm. And teaching a chat bot essentially to filter all the nuance and the context clues to what someone was actually asking.
Yeah, the most fascinating part about Watson on Jeopardy was when it went wrong in a lot of ways. Like, you could kind of see a logical train of how it might have ended up there, but it still was wrong.
Right, and I think I recall reading the application for Watson was intended to be at first for medical professionals, maybe, so that they could ask Watson or the Watson descendant a question to quickly get to some type of diagnosis, or at least ideas for a diagnosis.
That makes a lot of sense. And the other interesting thing from user experience perspective I saw in Mr. Robot in the game was looking at the idea of cognitive load. And so cognitive load is the idea that essentially you can present people with too many things to do or too many options, and then they just kind of get overloaded and shut down. There's been a lot of research on it by Nielsen Norman Group and other places. It's a pretty well-known concept. So generally when you're doing design work and designing an experience, you want to minimize cognitive load so people can more easily get through your stuff and buy things or whatever your goal is in the process. And this is one of the things that's changed my way of thinking about user experience a little bit as we look at these games, is that sometimes that's not something to be avoided. So one of the things in cognitive load that you end up with a lot is choice regret. So if you provide someone with too many choices, no matter what they end up with, they're going to regret not taking the others. And in this case, being the telltale model of giving you multiple choice to pick at every point in the conversation, I feel like that's probably by design. They want you to feel that agony over what the regret over the choice that you did not take without an easy back button, without an easy way to go jump back to a save point and see how it was done.
Yeah, but then counterpoint, you never visit a subway in a Telltale game.
Yeah.
A subway sandwich shop where you are asked to build the perfect sandwich yourself out of all the different permutations of sandwich possibilities.
Although that's probably something where they just ignore all the choices you made anyway.
You get the same sandwich.
Or it's in a bag, so you never get to see what was on it in the first place. So, you know, sometimes the user experience you might be aiming for in a game is what would not be desirable in a lot of other design areas. And I think that's an interesting balance to strike. But it also shows the effects of what cognitive load can do, which you can then apply elsewhere and say, well, that's clearly something we don't want in other systems that are not games. And not everything was perfect in the game. I don't want to feel like I'm saying this was the greatest thing in the world. Because it's essentially on Rails so much, I sometimes felt like I was the bot and the game was kind of playing me. I mean, I waited for my phone to buzz. I would pick it up and then I'd pick one of three choices and then the story would progress and I'd repeat that process. And I think it's an interesting proof of concept overall, but it maybe is not the perfect execution of it.
So how did this game differ from just a choose-your-own-adventure with enforced pauses?
I think it's the immersion factor of the idea that if you're reading a choose-your-own-adventure book, flipping around between the pages, you're not having the experience of being trapped on a spaceship with a vampire or whatever the book you've chosen is. Whereas with this, there's a little more plausibility, a little less less of a fourth wall between you and the story that's going on. It is a phone and there are messages coming in on it. That's what you do with a phone anyway. And it's a method of story delivery that I think could be reused in pretty much any environment, especially as more and more of society gets familiar with messaging as a primary method of interaction with others.
That's a good point. Maybe that could be a good simulation for maybe a tech on site somewhere. Mm-hmm.
And that was part of the game, actually. I had to harass a tech.
Oh, really?
loading a patch into something that he shouldn't have. And he was the most incompetent tech of all time, and I got extraordinarily frustrated with him. But it also makes me wonder a little bit if the game needs to be an app at all. Like, how much immersion do you want? Could they actually send you normal text messages on your phone and duplicate the experience? Probably 98% of this game could be done that way.
Right, I guess they would probably incur more costs, though, right? If
they were
actually sending you texts. That's what I was going to ask at first. I wasn't sure if you were getting real texts or if they're all coming within the context of the messaging app.
Yeah, it's all in that walled garden. But it's now that I've seen it in action, and especially as Telltale kind of refines their techniques over games, and I would expect to see something like this, but you know, much more interesting down the road in games. I could see it, you know, requiring you to take a picture of something and send it with your actual camera and using the kind of image recognition that Google does in Google Photos to say, yes, that is a picture of a dog. That's what I was looking for. You can proceed. So that's Mr. Robot, and it's a show that you should watch if you're not watching it. And it's a game that is probably worth playing. It costs $3, admittedly. It is not a free game, but I would say I got my $3 of entertainment out of it.
I'm surprised that they put a price tag on it. It seems like it would be a promotional tool, not a revenue generator.
I was a little surprised to see that, too. So maybe they'll do a one for season two and so on. It would be kind of interesting to see it continued, actually. I admit I have not uninstalled the game off of my phone. I kind of leave it there in the hopes that maybe another message will come someday.
Aw, that's adorable.
They got me. I'm hooked. Well, you've been listening to Gamification Unlocked. I'm Chad Haefeli.
And I'm Brandon Carper.
Please rate us on iTunes or your podcast app of choice. You can find us on Twitter at Unlocking Games, on the web at unlockinggames.com. We've got links to all the subscription services there. And if you have a minute, please send us a tweet or leave us a comment letting us know what you thought of the episode. And if you've seen any interesting applications of this kind of thing in training or user experience design. Until next time, it's your move.